Hello, I'm Tom Rollins, president of the Teaching Company. These lectures are part of the Superstar Teachers series, produced by the Teaching Company. The lectures on these tapes are titled Economics, Part 1, Microeconomics. The lecturer is Professor Timothy Taylor. Professor Taylor graduated from Haverford College in 1982 and received his master's degree in economics from Stanford University in 1984. Currently, he is the managing editor of the Journal of Economic Perspectives. Professor Taylor has taught introductory economics at Stanford University and at the University of Minnesota. His students and colleagues at both schools have acknowledged his outstanding teaching ability. In 1992, the Associated Students of Stanford University recognized him with an award for excellent teaching in a large class. And in 1994, he was named Distinguished Lecturer by the Department of Economics at the University of Minnesota. Professor Taylor has been a guest speaker for visiting diplomats from Eastern Europe, community organizations, and a variety of radio programs. Lecture 1, How Economists Think.
Many of you are probably starting this lecture series with some degree of worry and trepidation. After all, economics and economists don't exactly have the best of public reputations. There may be more jokes about economics than about any other subject I can think of. It's often a good notion to start an economics course by ventilating a few of those jokes so that they aren't hanging around in the back of your mind and disrupting your concentration later on. One of my favorite jokes is about Frankenstein's monster. Dr. Frankenstein is constructing his monster out of old body parts that he's found at the local cemetery. He's almost completely finished, but he doesn't yet have a brain. So this being an economics joke, he goes down to the local brain store in order to purchase that brain. He walks into the store. Young man behind the counter looks up at him, and Frankenstein says, "Well, I'm looking for a brain. What have you got in stock?" The young man says, "Well, we have some very nice psychologist brains here behind the counter, $10 a pound." And Frankenstein says, "Psychologist brains, I don't think they're quite right for my monster." The man behind the counter says, "Well, there's some very nice engineering brains here at $20 a pound." Frankenstein says, "No, I don't think so. Not engineering brains." The young man says, "Well, we have some very nice economist brains at $50 a pound." Frankenstein says, "$50 a pound? What is it that makes economist brains so expensive?" The young man behind the counter says, "Do you have any idea how many economists it takes to get a pound of brains?" Perhaps the most famous line about economists comes from Thomas Carlyle, famous British essayist of the 19th century. In one of his essays, Carlyle wrote that economics was, quote, "the dreary, desolate, and indeed quite distressing, what we might call by way of eminence, the dismal science." And that phrase, "the dismal science," has sort of stuck with the profession ever since. President Harry Truman was said several times to say that he wished he had a one-armed economist. Say, "Well, why a one-armed economist?" He would say, "Well, it's because he's so tired of people saying, well, on the one hand, on the other hand." He wanted someone with just one hand to tell him what was really up in the world. My wife's favorite economics joke is that she says economists are people who like to work with numbers but don't have the personality to be accountants. A good friend of mine at Stanford University, Victor Fuchs, likes to say that we've all heard of people who talk in their own sleep, but economists are people who talk in other people's sleep. With all of this concern and all of this foolishness, why persevere? Why study economics? Why look at it? Perhaps the best answer that I know of came from Joan Robinson, a famous British economist of the 1930s and 40s. When Joan Robinson was asked why study economics, she said, "To learn how to avoid being deceived by economists." I actually think that's a very astute answer. If you think about it, you've probably been in this kind of a conversation where you're advancing your point of view, you're feeling pretty good about your argument, you're moving forward, and then the person you're arguing with says, "Well, it's just basic economics that your point of view is wrong." Well, if you don't know any economics, how do you respond to that? If you don't know any economics, what's your answer? It sort of silences you. The truth is that that person who just told you it's just basic economics may not know any more economics than you do. But if you don't know any economics, you're in no position to respond to them. And so in some ways, knowing some economics gives you a certain kind of power and authority in social dialogue that avoids letting you be deceived either by economists or by those pretending to be economists. In general, if you know even a little bit of economics, I think you can go quite a long way in public policy disputes. Herb Stein, who was head of the Council of Economic Advisers under Richard Nixon and has been an economist in Washington for 50 years or something like that, wrote a few years ago, "It may seem a shocking thing to say, but most of the economics that's usable for advising on public policy is at about the level of the introductory undergraduate course. I sum up two main lessons of my 50 years as a Washington economist this way. Lesson one, economists do not know very much. Lesson two, other people, including the politicians who make economic policy, know even less about economics than economists do." This is a modest goal. We can achieve this goal. We can get up to a point where we know more economics, we know enough economics, that we can discuss things in a way which avoids the deep errors and avoids letting us be deceived. Before digging into this way of thinking about economics, how economists think, it's useful to spend a couple of moments on what economists don't think, on what economists really don't do. One common misconception is that economists spend a lot of their time forecasting the future. That's just flatly wrong. Probably tops 1 or 2% of the profession are those people you see quoted on the news all the time who are doing things like, what is the interest rate going to be 3 months from now, or how much will the economy grow next year? There are people who do that as a job, but it's certainly not what economics is all about. In fact, there's sort of some wry feeling among economists that after all, economics seems to be the only profession which is expected to have a perfect crystal ball. It seems to be the only profession where you're expected to forecast the future. Ken Arrow, a Nobel laureate economist at Stanford, used to say that no one expects, you know, to go to a biology department and say to the people in the biology department, well, forecast the next stage of evolution. And if you can't forecast the next stage of evolution, well, then biology must just not be a science. Nobody goes to the political scientists and says, tell us what legislation Congress will pass in the next year and exactly how many votes everyone will get. And if you can't do that, well, I guess political science just doesn't tell us anything at all. But people seem very comfortable coming to economists all the time and saying to them, well, tell us what the economy is going to be. And if you can't forecast it, if you can't predict what's going to happen, well, then economics must not mean much. When you think about it, it's actually really kind of a silly objection to the subject. Most economists spend most of their time thinking about connections and background and history and what's happened. They don't spend their time trying to think about what's going to happen 3 months from now. A second thing that economics is not about is that economics is not about helping business. It's not about helping labor. It's not about making profits. It's not about taking sides in the many social disputes that we have in our country. I would say economists in the profession as a whole, there are a lot of Republicans, there are a lot of Democrats. There's nothing in being an economist that says you have to believe one thing or another. Economics is not about drawing conclusions. It's not about having firm conclusions. Economics is a way of thinking about the questions that come up in the first place. John Maynard Keynes, one of the really famous economists of the 20th century, once wrote that economics is a method rather than a doctrine. Economics is an apparatus of the mind, a technique of thinking which helps its possessor to draw correct conclusions. What we want to try and emphasize in these lectures is that idea of economics as a method, as an apparatus, as a technique of thinking, not as something where if you are an economist, therefore you must believe X one way or another. What is this structure? What is this apparatus, this way of thinking? Well, to get into that, perhaps the easiest way in is to recognize that any society has to solve a basic problem of coordinating the people who produce stuff and the people who consume stuff. It has to figure out, really, an answer to three basic questions. Those three basic questions are, what should be produced in society? How should it be produced? And who gets it after it's produced? Every society comes up with an answer to these questions one way or another. It may be an answer by default, but it's always an answer. At one extreme, you can think of sort of a range of possible answers. And at one extreme, you can sort of think of the answer where the government answers all those questions itself. The government says, what will be produced? The government says, how will it be produced? The government says, who will get it? The government dictates everything. So we can think of that extreme as pure government control. At the other end of the spectrum, we can think of anarchy. We can think of no government at all, and everyone just doing everything that they can completely on their own hook. Now, of course, between those two, there's just a wide, wide range of possibilities. And most of the real world takes place in the middle range, not at one extreme where there's no government or at the other extreme where government controls absolutely everything. So if we started off at the end of the range where government doesn't do anything at all, we can sort of imagine government taking on more and more and more social roles. So, for example, it might start off with the government just doing something like guaranteeing that there won't be theft, that property rights will be upheld, that there will be contracts, that there will be a police presence, things like that. Then we can imagine the government doing a little bit more. For example, the government might start doing things like building roads and providing education and supporting an educational system. We could imagine government going a little further and providing certain kinds of incentives to private industry, incentives where to encourage them in one direction or another direction. We could imagine government actually owning those industries, not just providing incentives in one form. We could imagine government taking what's produced by those industries and directing who will get it and determining who will get it in some sort of way. Now, all of those involve the basic idea of government thinking about what the range of possibilities is and what things it ought to do. Now, in thinking about this sort of range of possibilities, there's a long tradition in social discourse of people at one end of the paradigm saying that people at the other end of the paradigm are venal, foolish, stupid, ignorant, and so on. You can imagine, for example, that the people who believe in a lot of government control, or a relatively large amount of government control, tend to say that the folks on the free market side, the less government side, you know, they don't care about the poor, they just care about businesses, they just care about profits, they have no social conscience, and you've heard those kinds of things. On the flip side, if you're down at the free market side and you're looking at the people who believe in a lot of government control, you hear things like, well, you know, they're just really communists. They don't really believe in any kind of free market. They believe in taking from people. They don't believe in incentives. They don't believe in letting people work hard. There's all kinds of things I'm sure you've heard as well. Modern economics is really not involved in that dispute, I think. In fact, that whole dispute I would like to think of as something that we can just leave out of this lecture series altogether. Our point is not to sort of categorize people as being ignorant, venal, stupid, foolish, on one end or the other. The whole point of modern economics is to think about this structure of thinking, this apparatus, and try and distinguish situations where the market works quite well, perhaps with only a little bit of government background, from where it might not work so well, and where other kinds of government intervention might be helpful in one way or another. And we're going to try and sort through those situations and work them out one way or another. Our goal is not to come to direct conclusions. Our goal is to illuminate these techniques, this apparatus of the mind that Keynes talked about. As a point of entry into thinking about these techniques, this apparatus of the mind, this way of thinking, I want to try and spend most of this lecture on some things that economists believe, but that other people, meaning most people in society, really don't believe. Now, in some of these things, your first reaction may be, well, of course I believe that. Everybody believes that. But I hope to illustrate to you that there are a lot of things that economists really believe in their gut at a deep level that most people, although they may say they believe it, when push comes to shove, they often don't. My first point, economists are people who take trade-offs seriously. Now, you might say, well, everyone knows you need to take trade-offs seriously. Well, maybe everybody knows it, but most of us may talk that talk, but we don't walk that walk. Particularly among politicians, when you think about it, most people who are advocating a point of view don't say, well, I think this is a good idea because these are the benefits, and, of course, I admit that it has some costs and some problems and some difficulties. I just think the benefits are bigger than the costs, which is why we ought to do it. Most people say, there are lots and lots of benefits, and there aren't any costs. The costs are so small, they don't matter. Don't even look at those costs. Anyone who tells you there are costs is wrong. Most of us, when we argue, have a tendency to do that, too. It's so much easier just to say that there aren't any costs than it is to admit there are costs, but say, hey, I think the costs are worthwhile. Let me give you a couple of examples where I think this trend is particularly vivid. One involves taxes on corporations. It's common in public dialogue to hear someone say, well, let's tax those corporations. Let's not have people pay taxes. Let's have corporations pay taxes instead. Now think about that for a moment. When a corporation pays taxes, a corporation is in one way or another interrelated with many people. An economist would say when a corporation pays taxes, that money has to come from someplace. It can't just come out of the air. Now, there are really three possible places for where the money could come from, if you're talking about corporations. One is that it could come from higher prices being charged to consumers. That's one possibility. Second possibility is it could come from the workers for that company receiving lower wages. It's another possibility. A third possibility is it could come from shareholders for that company or the investors in that company making lower profits. That's a third possibility. Now, my point here is not to argue that one or another of those possibilities is true. In fact, the evidence seems to be that a lot of the corporate tax does come from the people who invest in corporations. But my point is that when you talk about the corporate tax, you have to admit that it comes from someplace. You have to admit there's a trade-off. You can't just say, well, you know, corporations pay taxes, no one suffers. Someone suffers, it's a question of who, and whether you think that's a worthwhile trade-off to make. Another example. Let's think about the minimum wage. Say we raise the minimum wage. Our goal is to help people of low wages have a decent standard of living. Certainly a worthy goal. Economists would say the goal is perfectly worthy. Let's talk about the trade-offs. If we're going to pay people higher wages, the money has to come from someplace. Well, where could the money come from? There are several possibilities. This may sound familiar. One possibility is it could come from higher prices to consumers. Another possibility is it could come from having fewer people hired. The company might fire some workers, use that money that they save to pay the higher wages to other people. A third possibility is it could mean come out of lower profits to the shareholders or investors in that company. Now again, my point is not that it's one or the other. My point is the money has to come from someplace. And if you're going to be honest in talking about public policy, you have to say, okay, there's a trade-off. And there's a trade-off. I accept there's a trade-off. And I'm going to try and identify what it is and then argue that the benefits outweigh the costs. A second thing economists believe that I think other people typically don't believe. Economists believe in statistical people, not real people. Now, what do I mean by that exactly? If you watch news, particularly I think news on television, you tend to see that there's some person who appears on camera. I'm going to call that person Joe. And the point of the news story on television is typically that Joe has had a bad day. Joe may have lost his job. Joe may have discovered that the price of his apartment went way up, or the price of something he buys went way up. Joe may have found out that a government program he relies on might be cut back or trimmed back. Whatever the story, Joe is having a bad day. Economists would say, look, you can't set social policy based on Joe. I mean, Joe's a person, he counts, but presumably this policy affects a lot of people. It affects people you don't see, and it affects people that don't end up on camera because you can't interview every single one of them. So what you need to do somehow is think about the statistical people. Think about all those people who benefit and all those people who are hurt as statistics, that you balance out the costs and benefits. Because if we just focus in on one anecdote or another anecdote, there's always going to be somebody on each side. We'll never be able to make any decisions at all. If we're going to think about social policy, we're going to think about what's beneficial, we need to take an overall picture, and that means getting beyond the anecdotes and statistics. A third thing economists believe, I think other people often don't believe, selfishness can be an organizing principle for society. If you go around and you ask a lot of people, what would happen in our society? What would happen in any society, not so much this one, if people were primarily selfish, if selfishness was their main motivation? What would happen? What would those people do? Or what would happen to society? I think the standard answer you get is, if everyone's selfish, what you get is chaos. But economists, going back to Adam Smith more than two centuries ago, have come up with another answer. They point out that most market exchanges rely on selfishness. That when I go down to the grocery, I try and buy the best produce I can at the best price I can. I shop around at different places. When someone tries to sell me something, they're trying to make money. They're trying to make a living. And that's based on their own selfishness. And somehow this collision of selfishness, me trying to get the best deal for myself, the other person trying to make a living, works out in such a way that maybe we don't have a perfect society. In fact, there's little doubt we don't have a perfect society. But we don't exactly have chaos either. We have some sort of a pattern that emerges from all of these selfishnesses. And this pattern directs society in some useful ways. The phrase for this, which has sort of become the standard phrase, is due to Adam Smith, and it refers to this pattern that emerges as dictated by an invisible hand. Let me quote from Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations. Smith writes, "A person generally, indeed, neither intends to promote the public interest nor knows how much he is promoting it. He intends only his own gain, and he is in this, as in many other cases, led by an invisible hand to promote an end which was no part of his intention. Nor is it always the worse for society that it was no part of it. By pursuing his own interest, a person frequently promotes the interest of society more effectually than when he really intends to promote it. I have never known much good done by those who pretend to trade for the public good. It is an affectation indeed, not very common among merchants, and very few words need be employed in dissuading them from it." I think that's sort of a wonderful burst of Adam Smith, this sort of cynicism about, I've never known much good done by people who pretend to trade for the public good. That actually, more good may be done by people who are out there trying to shop and buy things in their own best interest and work hard for their families than is done by people who explicitly are saying, you know, I don't care about myself, I don't care about anything else, I'm just trying to achieve the public good. A fourth thing economists believe, I think other people don't. Economists don't believe in individual responsibility for prices. I think most people do believe in individual responsibility for prices. If, for example, your rent goes up on your apartment, you say, well, that's the landlord's fault. The landlord raised my rent. I hate it when they do that. Or if the price of gasoline goes up at the pump, people say, well, I hate it that, you know, the oil company, they raised the price of gasoline. Boy, I just hate it when the oil company raises the price of gasoline. They're just greedy. Or if, say, the bank raises the interest rate on your mortgage or pays you less on your bank deposit, you say, well, those banks, they're always just moving the interest rate. I hate it when they move the interest rate. They're out to get me. We take the price change and we blame it on whoever we're dealing with. That explanation doesn't work very well if you give it just a little bit of thought. After all, there's no doubting that the landlord is greedy. There's no doubting that the bank is greedy. There's no doubting that the oil company is greedy. They're all greedy. Let's just go with that as an idea. After all, the whole basic idea here, remember, is that selfishness, everyone is selfish. This is an organizing principle. But here's the question. If they were greedy all along, they were greedy yesterday and the day before that and the day before that, then we can't explain why they raised the price today. After all, they were just as greedy yesterday. Why didn't they raise the price yesterday? They were just as greedy the day before that. They didn't suddenly become more greedy on this particular day. So their greed is a constant. If the greed is a constant, it can't explain why things change day to day. Presumably, what's changed is not that they've become more greedy, but that something in the market has changed which allowed them to raise their prices, which allowed them to express their greed, if you want to think of it in that way. Now, that idea that the market is allowing people to do things, that there are forces of supply and demand out there in the market, and that that's what determines price, is really where economists start to come in. Now, if that seems a little shaky to you, let me put it the other way to you. If you're going to blame individuals for being greedy when the price of things go up, are you going to give them credit for being generous when the price of things go down? For example, when the price of gasoline goes down a little bit, are you going to say, gee, Exxon, they were nice to me today. You know, they didn't have to do it. They were just sweet. They just lowered the price of gasoline. I like them. They're generous. They're not greedy anymore. Of course you're not going to say that. They're just as greedy now as they were the day before. What changed is something in the market changed in a way that forces them to lower the price. And they're no more doing it out of altruism today than they were raising the price out of greed yesterday. Prices don't come out of individual decisions. Prices come out of the interaction of forces of supply and demand. We'll need to step back and look at those forces more carefully. A fifth thing for economists. Economists believe that incentives matter. Let me give you a couple of examples of incentives mattering. And again, you might say, well, everyone believes incentives matter. That's certainly not true. I just read a poll a few days ago in the newspaper. It was a poll about teenage smoking and whether or not we should have higher cigarette taxes to discourage teenage smoking. And in that particular poll, a majority of the people who were answering, I believe it was a two-thirds majority, said, you know, raising the tax on cigarettes has no effect on whether kids smoke or not. I mean, kids want to smoke or they don't want to smoke. That's just what kids do. And, you know, it just doesn't make any difference one way or the other. Now, for economists, that's just a peculiar thing to say. To be sure, there may be some kids who will smoke no matter what, but there will be also be some kids where as the price goes up, they'll do something else with their money. Now, it may not be something good. I mean, maybe instead of smoking tobacco, they'll smoke clove cigarettes. Maybe instead of tobacco, they'll drink beer. Maybe instead of tobacco, I mean, they'll play video games. They could do a lot of different things with their money. The point is that as the price goes up, some people will perceive a trade-off, and that incentive will matter. It will make a difference. One of the funniest examples I saw recently of incentives mattering involves mad cow disease in Britain. As you may be aware, there's this disease, cows have it, and there's some danger that if you eat beef that is infected with mad cow disease, you can get terrible brain disease and die. Well, when this was first announced in Britain, as you can imagine, people stopped buying beef. So beef is piling up on the supermarket shelves. What do you do in that situation? People are afraid to buy this because they're afraid it's infected meat. Well, Sainsbury, a big grocery store in London, cut the price of beef by half, and it sold out immediately. Now, you might say, well, people wouldn't buy infected beef at half price. They will. Some of them will, certainly. And that's true of so many things, that if the price is different, people will adjust one way or another. In the last few decades, perhaps the most well-known example of this thing about prices adjusting or not adjusting happened when oil prices shot up really dramatically during the mid-70s. If you go back and read things that were written about that time, lots and lots of people said, well, price of oil is up and there's nothing we can do about it. After all, we have to heat our homes, we have to drive our cars, we have to run our factories. We're just stuck. We just have to pay whatever they say. That's it. We're stuck. Well, but when the price of oil went up, incentives did matter. And what happened was that as the price of oil went up, people began to put more insulation in their homes. They began to put their thermostats in the winter at 68 or 65 instead of 72. They began to change and buy more fuel-efficient cars. Many, many patterns began to evolve. And as a result, the U.S. actually uses less oil now than it did 25 years ago, even though the gross domestic product is much, much higher. We do adjust over time. Incentives do matter. Moreover, perhaps the ultimate proof is that the sort of social philosophies based on the idea that incentives don't matter, the ones where there's a lot of government control, have really not worked out very well. If you say to people, well, we're just going to pay everyone the same, no matter whether you show up or don't show up, no matter whether you work hard or don't work hard, we're just going to pay everybody the same, because we're not worried about incentives mattering, I guarantee you, your factory will go broke. It just doesn't work very well to pretend that incentives don't matter. So, in case after case after case, economists keep coming back to that idea. A sixth thing economists believe. Economists believe that exchange creates wealth. This idea takes a little bit of explaining. But to begin it, think that wealth, first of all, to economists, is not made up of material things. No, wealth is really made up of the happiness in your mind. Take this thought experiment. Imagine that here in the classroom, all of us were to empty our pockets. We were to take everything out of our pockets. You know, the pens, the few little loose change, some keys, all that kind of stuff. And we were to sit down and we were to start trading amongst ourselves. We were to say, you know, you want a blue flare pen? Do you want some keys? Want a keychain? Economists would say that if we make some trades, then the amount of wealth in this room has gone up. Now, why is that? I mean, nothing has entered the room, nothing has left the room. How can it be that the amount of wealth has gone up? Well, the logic is that if two people make a trade, they must both be better off in their own mind. After all, they wouldn't trade unless they each felt that they were improving their situation. So if they each trade, then the wealth in the room, in the sense of happiness in people's minds, must be higher than it was before. Not only does exchange promote wealth in that basic notion that trading back and forth, voluntary trading, must increase people's wealth, but exchange also sets the possibility for us to specialize in different things. I mean, I think sometimes of what I do for a living. I run an academic economics journal. I teach economics courses. I occasionally do some writing or editing. You know, I grow no food. I make no clothes. I build no houses. But somehow, I manage to live perfectly well by doing what I want, but doing things that I specialize in, focusing in on those things, and then trading with other people who do other things. Exchange creates the possibility that we can all specialize and then trade with each other. And that process of specializing makes us all more efficient at what we can do and creates the possibility that we can all be wealthier. I am certainly much wealthier than I would be if I were living on my own, like Robinson Crusoe or the Swiss Family Robinson, trying to produce absolutely everything that I do. Robert Heilbronner, a contemporary economist, has pointed out that the overwhelming majority of Americans have never grown food, caught game, raised meat, ground grain into flour, or even fashioned flour into bread. Faced with the challenge of clothing themselves or building their own homes, they would be hopelessly untrained and unprepared. Even to make minor repairs in the machines that surround them, they must call on other members of the community whose job it is to fix cars or repair plumbing or whatever. Paradoxically, perhaps, the richer the nation, the more apparent is this inability of its average inhabitants to survive unaided and alone. As we specialize, as we trade, we tend to get richer and richer. A seventh thing economists believe. Economists say, don't use prices to redistribute. Now, what do I mean by that? Let's think that we want to help some group. Say that we want to help the poor. One common proposal that comes up is, well, let's take all the things that the poor buy, like apartments, and let's keep the prices of those things low. We'll use controlling the price in order to redistribute to that group. Or say with farmers, if we want to help farmers, we'll redistribute to farmers, we'll help farmers by making the price of farm products high. We'll use the price as a way of redistributing. The problem here is that as you move the price up and down, the price alters the incentives that are available in the market. If you start making the price of apartments very low, as we'll be talking about more on lecture four, people have less incentive to provide apartments and to build apartments and to maintain apartments. And as they do that, you're going to have to deal with that incentive problem. If you give farmers a guaranteed high price, they tend to produce an awful lot of stuff that maybe you didn't really want, and then you have to deal with that stockpile that's been produced. So when you use prices to redistribute, you have to think about what are the incentives that you're creating. Alan Blinder, a contemporary economist, wrote a book a few years back, which was called Soft Hearts, Hard Heads, in sort of a philosophy of economics kind of book. And I think that phrase, soft hearts, hard heads, exactly sums up how economists want to think. We want to say, look, we're soft-hearted. We want to help certain groups, but we want to be hard-headed in how we think about it. We don't want to just sort of give in to whatever the easiest way of thinking is. For economists, if you want to help a group, whether it's the poor, whether it's the farmers, whether it's some other group, there's a relatively simple answer. Give them money. Don't change the price. Give them money. Where do you get the money? Tax people. And then have an argument which says that it's worth taxing these people to give money to those people. Costs and benefits. Let the trade-offs be open. Decide what happens. An eighth thing economists believe that I think other people often don't believe. Economists say that you should think of all costs as what economists call opportunity costs. An opportunity cost just means that when you think about the cost, you should think about it as what you give up. So, for example, in my own life, one of the things that we struggle with as a married couple is, should we have house cleaners? And if we should have house cleaners, how often should we have them? Should we have them weekly, every other week, once a month, once every 3 months? What should we do? My way of thinking about this, of course, is to say to my wife, okay, let's take the cost of the house cleaner and multiply it out for the year. Works out to several thousand dollars. That's a Caribbean vacation. So, are you willing to give up a Caribbean vacation for the house cleaners? My wife, of course, thinks this is fighting dirty. But for economists, thinking about things in terms of what do you give up is really the true cost. What are you willing to trade off? And if you're not willing to trade that off, then you should think twice about what you do. The costs are not always monetary costs. Costs can also be time. For example, if you go on and get a graduate degree at school, you're not just giving up the cost of monetary cost of paying tuition and things like that. You're giving up money that you could have earned during that time that you were in school, which often get double the cost if you think about it as opportunity cost. Another way that cost often comes up is imagine that you're at imagine you're at a movie you don't like. Well, you've paid your money. You're sitting in this movie. You've been there an hour. It's the worst movie you've ever seen. You can't imagine it getting any better. Do you get up and walk out of that movie? I mean, after all, your time's worth something, right? You could be doing something else with that time. But somehow a lot of us have this attitude which is, well, I paid for it. By golly, I'm going to sit here and look at it. And the attitude seems to be that spending an hour in a terrible movie is the best use of my time. It's better than being out on the street. It's better than getting a cup of coffee. It's better than anything else I can think of. That seems to me a very weird attitude, distinctly non-economic. A final thing economists believe. Economists believe that markets are a powerful force of nature. Just a powerful force of nature. George Stigler, a Nobel Prize winning economist who died a few years ago, used to say that the more you study markets, the greater your respect for them will be. Let me give you a couple examples of thinking about the power of markets. One is, let's think about pencils for a moment. Pencils are a simple example. It's not a high-tech product. But there's probably true that there's no one on the planet who could make a pencil from scratch. Think it over. What goes into a pencil? I mean, there's all the process of lumbering and wood products and trimming the wood for the pencil. There's the process of the glue which holds the pencil together. There's the graphite in the middle of the pencil, a whole different set of processes in chemistry. There's the metal tab around the pencil at the top that holds the eraser on, yet another substance. Then there's paint and stamping machines and all the rest. Now, you never like to say this, there's probably some esteemed professor somewhere like, you know, MIT or Stanford who understands all the chemistry and all the technology and all the manufacturing processes that go into all of those objects. But actually, I probably doubt it. There probably isn't anyone. But the result of our market is that pencils are made so cheaply and so easily that when you drop one on the floor, half the time you don't even bother to pick it up. Now, anything like a market which can produce something as complicated as a pencil and make it so cheap that you basically ignore it, that's a force that has to be respected. It's not a force you can shy away from very easily. Another favorite example of mine goes back to a 19th century economist, Frederick Bastiat. Bastiat wrote a number of essays. In this essay, he describes looking out at the city of Paris. This was written in 1845. On entering Paris, which I had come to visit, I said to myself, here are a million human beings who would all die in a short time if provisions of every kind ceased to flow toward this metropolis. Imagination is baffled when it tries to appreciate the vast multiplicity of commodities which must enter tomorrow through the barriers of the city in order to preserve the inhabitants from falling prey to the convulsions of famine, rebellion, and pillage. And yet, all sleep at this moment, and their peaceful slumbers are not disturbed for a single instant by the prospect of such a frightful catastrophe. How does each succeeding day bring what is wanted, nothing more, nothing less, to so gigantic a market? What is the ingenious and secret power which governs the astonishing regularity of movements so complicated, a regularity in which everybody has implicit faith, though happiness and life itself are at stake? That power is a principle, the principle of freedom in transactions. We must have faith in that inward light which Providence has placed in the heart of all men, and to which he has confided the preservation and amelioration of our species, namely, a regard to personal interest, since we must give it its right name. This principle so active, so vigilant, so foreseeing when free in its action. In what situation, I would ask, would the inhabitants of Paris be if a minister should take it into his head to substitute for this power the combinations of his own genius, however superior we might suppose them to be? If the minister thought to subject to his supreme discretion this prodigious mechanism, to hold the springs of it in his hands, to decide by whom, in what manner, or on what conditions, everything needed should be produced, transported, exchanged, and consumed. Truly, there may be much suffering within the walls of Paris, poverty, despair, perhaps starvation, causing more tears to flow than ardent charity is able to dry up. But I affirm that it is probable, nay, it is certain, that the arbitrary intervention of government would multiply infinitely those sufferings, and spread over all our fellow citizens those evils which at present affect only a small number of them. I think that's sort of a breathtaking rendition of what economists believe. Markets are a powerful force of nature. They make pencils. They feed cities. Anything which is powerful enough to make pencils and feed cities is a force you have to respect. Now, I should be very clear on this, because it's, I think, where a lot of confusion about economics comes up. When I say it's a force you have to respect, I'm not saying that it's a force you have to be fond of. I'm not saying it's a force you have to like. I'm not saying it's a force that all the consequences are things you should enjoy. I'm not saying that it's a force which is positive in every way. I'm just saying it's a powerful force of nature, like a tornado is powerful. Like photosynthesis is powerful. And when you think about powerful forces, the one that's really important about them is don't ignore them. Don't pretend they aren't there. Don't pretend they've gone away. Don't pretend you can just set them aside and not pay attention to them. When you've got a powerful force of nature, you have to pay attention to it and figure out how to work with it. The remainder of these lectures is really divided up into two major parts. The first 10 lectures, that is the next 9 after this one, are focused on microeconomics. Microeconomics is looking at economics from the bottom up. It's looking at all the trees in the forest, if you want to think of it in that way. So when you think about microeconomics, you think about supply and demand. You think about individual people making individual decisions about working, about consuming, about saving. You think of individual businesses making decisions about how to work, how to produce things, how to distribute things, how to make money. Microeconomics is that bottom-up view of society. The second 10 lectures will work on macroeconomics. Macroeconomics is going to be focused on the big picture view. So it'll be focused on unemployment, inflation, overall economic growth, trade deficit, things like the federal budget, the Federal Reserve Bank, monetary policy, all those kinds of issues. Now, of course, microeconomics and macroeconomics, although they're sometimes taught as two separate courses, you really shouldn't think of them as two separate subjects. Really, they're just two separate perspectives on the same subject. One perspective sort of looks at it from one direction. The other perspective looks at the economy from the other direction. But one of the things we want to do as we work through microeconomics and macroeconomics is kind of make the links between them relatively clear, so you can see how they interact and intertwine with each other. I think of it sometimes as if you were studying a forest. There are some people who study the trees in the forest, or they even would go down to studying, you know, at the microscopic level, the algae under the leaves and things like that. That's the real microeconomic view of the forest. Other people look at the overall forest patterns, how they grow, the patterns of forest fires, different patterns like that. That's the macroeconomic view. But it's all the same forest, and in the end, you want to see how the interactions work, both back and forth, between these different perspectives. As we think about economics, what I want to leave you with for this first lecture are the thoughts of John Maynard Keynes, who in a book he wrote in 1921 spelled out, perhaps as well as anyone has, what we hope to achieve with economics and how we hope to think about the world of economics. Keynes was defining what was a master economist. What does a master economist do? How do they think? And Keynes wrote, "The master economist must understand symbols and speak in words. He must contemplate the particular in terms of the general and touch abstract and concrete in the same flight of thought. He must study the present in light of the past for the purposes of the future. No part of man's nature or his institutions must lie entirely outside his regard. The economist must be purposeful and disinterested in a simultaneous mood, as aloof and incorruptible as an artist, yet sometimes as near the earth as a politician." I hope that as we investigate economics in the lectures to come, we can approach that idea of the master economist in all of us.